This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to UCSB. It's my pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about my research with all of you today. So I want to start with a question. So what is the major societal challenge of our time? Climate change. And so climate change is due to the emission of greenhouse gases from anthropogenic sources, meaning from human actions, and it leads to extreme weather events, it leads to rising sea levels, it leads to rising global temperatures, and all of these have impacts on the environment, for example. On the environment, so if you have droughts, for example, this leads to wildfires. We've seen this in California. This is one in Montana. It also has negative consequences on human health, and you have a number of consequences. I'm just going to point out one of them, which is food insecurity, again, coming from droughts and the loss of crops. And finally, climate change can lead to conflicts and global instability due to the displacement of populations from, for example, sea level rise. And one of the major sources of greenhouse gas emissions from human actions is coming from energy production. And the way we produce energy today is mostly coming from burning fossil fuels. And when you burn fossil fuels, you're emitting greenhouse gases such as CO2 in the atmosphere, which leads to smog, acid rain, and climate change. And so I want to show you a graph here showing the evolution of CO2 emitted in the atmosphere coming from the burning of coal and natural gas to produce electricity and heat between the year 2000 and 2022, which was the last time this data was recorded. And this is in gigatons of CO2. So this is the annual amount in gigatons, which is 10 to the 12 tons, so a large number here. And as you can see, there's an increase in the overall amount of CO2 we produce from these. And what's happening after this dotted line here is what needs to happen if by 2050 we want to reduce those CO2 emissions to zero. And this is a pledge that many countries around the world have decided to take. However, at this time, government commitments are not sufficient to achieve this goal. So this is showing you the evolution of our energy consumption over time, again, from 1800 to 2023. And if I zoom in here on what happens now, and I'll note that the energy axis here is in terawatt hour, so trillions of watt hours, and you're looking at 100,000 of trillions of watt hours, so it's a big number here. And this is the amount of energy we're consuming every year. And nowadays, we're at about 76% of that energy coming from fossil fuels, 4% coming from nuclear, and the rest, about 20%, coming from renewable energies. And what you can see here is a drastic increase from 1950 onwards. What's notable, too, is that the initial energy that we were using and that we've been using constantly throughout this period is biomass. It hasn't changed very much. It's now a small proportion of the energy that we are using. And from 1800 till 1850, this was the only type of energy we used. And then from 1850, we started to diversify the types of energies that we've been using. This was the industrialization age when we started to produce things at the mass scale, and we also started to use coal at that time. So coal, there's an increase in the use of coal from 1850, an increase in the use of oil and hydropower from 1900, and then natural gas and nuclear started to really rise after 1950. And it's only in the late 20th century that we started to diversify renewable energies, such as wind power and solar power. And you can see here that this increase is still rapidly growing, right? In 2024, global electricity demand increased again by 4.3%, which is very substantial. And there are a few reasons for this. One is that global population is still growing, so we still need to meet the needs of more and more people on Earth. But also economic development is a big one, where countries that are still developing are becoming richer, and as they become richer, they also increase their energy consumption. The electrification of transportation and of heating is also driving this increase in electricity demand. Increased use of cooling because our Earth is warming up is also a component of this. And then finally, recent technological advancements such as AI and data centers are huge energy consumers. So you might be wondering at this point when I'm going to start to talk about batteries. So batteries are an essential component of moving towards more renewable energy sources, greener types of energies, which are not leading to the emission of greenhouse gases. So let's take the example of solar here. And if we imagine for a second that we are only using solar energy, and if we compare our energy demand throughout the course of one day and the energy generated from solar over the course of the same day, what you see is that there's a clear mismatch in when we are, when we need energy, which you know is peaking in the evening here, when we're cooking, when we're lighting, when we're using lighting, when we're heating, and there's a clear mismatch about when we need the energy and when we are generating it from solar, which peaks in the middle of the day. So, in order to bridge the gap between when we produce this energy and when we need it, we need energy storage, and batteries are an excellent way of doing that. So this is only one of the possible applications of batteries. This is called grid storage because you're storing energy that you've produced from a particular energy source, and then you release it into the electrical grid. But you can also use batteries for electric vehicles, you can use batteries for portable electronics and defense applications. At this point, I want to pause for a second and kind of give you my background in that field. Why did I get interested in batteries in the first place? So this was when I was an undergrad and I was looking for a master's project, and I really wanted to be involved in developing a technology that can help us combat climate change. So that was really the initial driving force. And then the more I started to think about the problems that needed to be solved to make batteries better, the more I got interested in the topic. So my goal today is really to share with you why battery research is important and why it's fun. So if you want to understand how batteries work, you need to understand the basic principles of electrochemistry. And so Luigi Galvani was a medical doctor, and he was a professor of anatomy. And he did a number of experiments trying to understand how muscle stimulation using electricity works. And so for these types of experiments, he would use dead frogs. And in this particular experiment, he connected the spinal cord of this poor frog with its leg muscle using two types of metals, bronze and iron. And what he realized in this experiment was that when the metals touched, the leg of the frog would twitch. And so he developed this theory that the electricity was coming from the animal itself. So he called it animal electricity, and he thought that the brain was the main organ that was secreting this electrical fluid that would then travel through the spinal cord to the muscle, which would then lead to contraction of that muscle. And he also thought that the metals were only here to pass some current, to close the circuit, but they weren't generating the current themselves. So then came Volta. He was a contemporary of Luigi Galvani, but he disagreed with Galvani. He thought animal electricity is not a thing. It must be that the two metals that are connected here, the contact between these two dissimilar metals is leading to an electrical current. And so he started to experiment with a number of metal combinations, and he would basically place two pieces of metal on his tongue and let them touch and see if he could feel an electrical current, not to be done at home. And so he found that with a number of metal combinations, he could indeed feel the current in his tongue. But the metals needed to be two different pieces of metal. If he was using the same metal with the two pieces, he didn't feel any current. And so this led him to develop the voltaic pile, which is the first battery that was ever made. And so that pile, as the name suggests, is a stack of zinc discs and copper discs that are separated by a piece of cloth that is soaked with salt water. And this particular device, when you connect the negative pole and the positive pole, can deliver some electricity. So Humphrey Davy was another scientist here who, after Volta, looked at this voltaic pile more closely, and he disagreed with Volta. So Volta thought that the the contact between two dissimilar metals is what generates the energy, the electricity. And Humphry Davy disagreed with that. What he thought was going on in this voltaic pile was that there were electrochemical reactions, so there are chemical reactions within the device that are leading to the generation of electrons and an electrical current. So he thought, okay, in these types of devices, we have electrochemical reactions that lead to a current, but vice versa, if you have a current, you can generate a chemical reaction. So it goes both ways. And he was able to prove this using, for example, a chemical here called sodium hydroxide. And he found that when he passed a current through this substance, it would transform into sodium. So he was able to show this with a large number of chemical compounds and induce a chemical change by passing a current through these. This is a process called electrolysis. And then his student, Michael Faraday, developed a theory really showing the connection between an electrical current and electrochemical reactions. And this is really at the basis of how batteries work. So if we go into a bit more detail on the voltaic pile here, we have, just like any battery, we have two electrodes called the cathode and the anode, and we have an electrolyte, which in this case is the salt water. So your copper is the cathode, your zinc is the anode. And if you close the circuit here, if you connect the negative pole of your battery with the positive pole, what you'll find is that chemical reactions start to happen. So the electrochemical reactions here are important because one is generating electrons. So this E minus sign here is the sign of an electron. So at the anode, we're generating electrons through an electrochemical reaction. These electrons flow through the external circuit, through the piece of wire, to the cathode. And at the cathode, we are consuming those electrons. And so this current that flows allows you to power a device. And that's what's going on in that voltaic pile. But this is a primary battery, so it's not rechargeable. Once you've used all of the zinc here and all of these hydrogen ions here, your battery is completely discharged and you cannot recharge it. So a lithium-ion battery has pretty much the same concept. So we still have our anode and our cathode, and we have our electrolyte between, so it's a liquid, and the separator is what you saw as the piece of cloth in your voltaic pile. So the piece of cloth and the separator are separating the two electrodes so that they don't touch and they don't, it doesn't create a short circuit. So I'm showing these electrode materials as little balls here. And the reason for this is because when we make lithium-ion battery electrodes, these are as solid powders. So the little balls here are the particles of these electrodes. And they are agglomerated in the electrodes. And what's special about a lithium-ion battery is that these anode and cathode materials are able to store lithium ions reversibly. So during charge and discharge, as I'm going to show you, these lithium ions are extracted and reinserted into these materials. So if you close the circuit, you have an electrochemical reaction at the anode that releases those lithium ions. They flow through the electrolyte and they insert into the cathode material. And you have electrons going from the anode to the cathode, and you can use that to power a device. And then on charge, you connect a powering device, you're recharging your battery, and you force these electrons to move in the reverse direction. And you're also forcing the lithium ions out of the cathode material back into the electrolyte towards the anode, and they reinsert into the anode material. So what's special about these lithium-ion batteries is that these charge, or the electrochemical reactions that happen on charge and discharge are reversible, which allows you to recharge them. But finding electrochemical or materials here for the anode and cathode that lead to electrochemical reactions that are 100% reversible is actually very challenging. And that's essentially what we are asking of these devices, to be able to charge and discharge them many, many times. So what are the major challenges of lithium-ion batteries? Cost. You've probably heard that EVs are typically more expensive than a standard car. It turns out that in China, it's almost at price parity with a standard car. So it's a challenge, but it's manageable, and it's something that cost will be reduced for rechargeable batteries in the future. Safety is also a challenge. Lithium-ion batteries are safe if you charge them correctly and if you store them correctly. But if you have a lithium-ion battery fire, it's extremely difficult to stop. And so this is an example of an event that happened in a battery storage facility in Monterey County, so up the coast from here. And it's the largest storage facility worldwide. And this fire happened in February of this year, and it destroyed half of that facility. Sourcing metals for lithium-ion batteries is also a challenge. So if you're increasing your demand for lithium-ion batteries, you're also increasing the demand for these rare metals that we have in these batteries, including lithium, but also nickel and cobalt. And mining these metals it damages the environment, of course, but it's also problematic from a human health perspective and from a cultural perspective. And in the US, there's a push to develop mines domestically for lithium, for example. And this is one of them that's being developed in Nevada right now, but it is developed on a land that's considered sacred by Native Americans. So it's clearly raising issues. So what do we do in my group? So we develop new chemistries, new materials for lithium-ion batteries. So we're looking at new electrode materials that can store more lithium, because the more lithium you can store, the more energy dense your battery. We also want to find materials that store lithium quickly so that we can charge and discharge quickly these devices. We care about cost effectiveness and sustainability. So we're also developing battery chemistries that are more sustainable, made of sodium instead of lithium because sodium is more abundant on Earth, made of manganese and iron instead of nickel and cobalt for those reasons. And finally, we care about safety, so we're developing electrolytes that are less flammable than the ones that we're using today. So when we have a battery fire, it's typically because the electrolyte is catching fire. So we are developing electrolytes that are made of water and made of solids, which are much less flammable. All right, so I'm going to show you a video in the last few minutes of my talk, but before that, I want to go through the steps of how we develop a new battery material in the lab. So I'll take an example of an electrode material. So if we want to make an electrode material from scratch, typically we use a synthesis process that's called a solid state synthesis. And what that means is that the reagents are in the form of solid powders that we mix together using a mortar and pestle, and then we press them into a compact pellet. And then that pellet is then placed in a furnace, and it's baked at very high temperatures, typically between 800 to 1,100 degrees Celsius, and for many hours. And then after that, you've got a chemical reaction that happens during that baking process, and you can retrieve your target material from the furnace. So you end up with this electrode material that you targeted, you break it back into a powder, you can grind it back down, and then you can make a film out of it. So say we've made a cathode material, we can make a little film, which is this black disc here, and you can build a lithium-ion battery around it. And you'll see this in the video. And then we can charge and discharge this device. And if we make a number of these batteries, we can stub them at different states of charge and at different states of discharge. So what I'm showing you here is a graph where we have the voltage of that cell as a function of the capacity. And the capacity is the amount of lithium that you can extract on charge and reinsert on discharge. So if you stop this battery at different time points, and if you open it, and if you take the material out, you can then study it and understand how these electrochemical reactions are happening and if there are any issues in terms of reversibility of these reactions. So that's what we call characterization. When we talk about characterization, we're talking about the study of these materials. So let's look at the video.
So we're going to go through a number of students here in the lab. Hannah is going to show us some parts of making pellets, which is what we bake when we make those materials. And then we'll look at the baking process itself, and then battery making, and finally characterization of the battery materials.
Hi, I'm Hannah, and I'm a second year grad student in the Clermont group. And today I'll be pressing some pellets out of this cathode material for sodium ion batteries. This is kind of a step in our synthesis to make this material. It's already been synthesized, but we're going to put it through an anneal process, so the pellets are necessary to actually do that.
My name is Vincent. I'm a recent graduate in the Clermont Group. So I'm going to be walking you guys through the synthesis, microwave synthesis of our cathode active materials. And so the way it works, I'm going to start prepping it. We have some of these pellets that are pre-pressed. So I'm going to show you here. So I'm going to prepare a setup. We have kind of two crucibles here.
See.
And then I'm going to pour some carbon into one. And then embed the second crucible inside. And then place the precursor pellet in here. So this is a double crucible setup. So the carbon will heat first. And then just by standard heat transfer processes, you'll heat the pellet. And at some point, the microwaves will directly interact with the pellet. So I'm gonna place it in here. And just close it. And then so we're going to do a 5-minute reaction. So 5 minute. So after the first minute, you'll start to see glowing, and then by minute 2 or 3, you'll see it really start to glow like red hot, right? And the cool thing we'll do afterwards is that we actually quench this, so you'll get to see that in action. There's going to be a growing pellet I'm going to hold up and then quench it in here.
Hi, my name is Olivia, and today I am building a lithium metal symmetric coin cell. We use these cells for basic electrochemical testing to help us understand what is going on with our anodes in our batteries, our electrolytes in our batteries. They're a good model system, and they're quite easy to build. So I'll show you how. I'm beginning with a piece of lithium metal. This is something you might not have seen before, but lithium looks like this in its pure form. In order to turn this into a battery electrode, we first need to clean it, and we clean it with one of these. I'll now show you that we punch out our electrodes so we have a nice even shape every time. So to make one of these electrodes, all you do is you punch it out of this sheet of metal. And you have something that looks like that. And once you extract it from your punch without damaging it or bending it, you have one piece of our battery. So this gets put onto a spacer to make sure that our coin cell is the right thickness. Spacers look like this. Ours are made out of stainless. Lithium is kind of sticky, so it stays in the middle very nicely by itself. All you have to do is take your clean finger and press it on to where it's supposed to live, and that'll do just fine. So then I'm actually going to make a battery sandwich. So to make any of these, you just put all the layers together like a jigsaw. And you like these coin cells because they are fast and repeatable, so we get consistent performance. Then this gets put into our press in order to actually seal it shut. To use this, you load your cell top down. Coins the door to prevent any fingers from being trapped. This keeps all of our cells nice and consistent because we can press with the same amount of force every time. We can go in and retrieve our new cell. Now we have our little watch battery ready for whatever testing it needs to go on do.
I'm Ash Patterson. I'm a fourth year grad student in Lopez Group, and I'm packing a NMR loader. So I have a sample here. We want to look at it using NMR, solid-state NMR, because it's a really great way to see the local structure inside the material. And because my material is air-sensitive, I have to do this in the glove box. This is the NMR loader. This is a 1.3 millimeter. The reason it's so small is because in order to get essentially good resolution for my NMR spectrum, I have to spin this at 60 kilohertz, which is extremely fast. And so they have to make these loaders extremely tiny. Can you see that?
Yeah, for them.
This is a pretty tricky operation to do in the glove box, packing a 1.3 millimeter. I put it first into this tiny funnel, and then it really just requires a tiny amount of sample, so a few milligrams.
So we should do the pack.
And then because we want this pretty densely packed,
looks like
I take this 1 millimeter drill bit and pack the sample down inside. So we just press firmly down and then it's ready to go.
All right. Well, I want to thank my students for all of their work. You've seen a few of them here in this video, Ash, Hannah, and Olivia. And I also want to mention that, you know, we are doing a lot of basic science in this group, a lot of fundamental research to develop better batteries, but none of this would be possible without our funders, our sponsors here. And so I'd like to acknowledge the NSF, the Office of Naval Research, and the Department of Energy on the government side. And then we have a lot of sponsors from industry. And my final note is, you know, there's still a lot to be done in that field. There's so much to do to improve batteries further. And so I hope some of you will join us in that adventure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.